Summer, 1943. Hamburg is burning. From late July to early August, hundreds of British bombers have launched four major raids on the German city. It is Germany's largest seaport and a vital industrial centre, which makes it a prime target in Bomber Command's quest to smash Germany's war-making capabilities. The RAF Bomber Force deploys its method of night area bombing, which by 1943 has become maturer and more effective. These tactics, along with the hot, dry weather of summer, create a firestorm, which drew in the surrounding air and became an uncontrollable inferno that engulfed 4 square miles of Hamburg, pulverizing buildings, uprooting trees, and turning people into living torches. It also sucked air out of basement shelters thousands were cowering in, and they suffocated or died of carbon monoxide poisoning. In total, over 8,300 tons of incendiaries and high explosives were dropped on Hamburg in those raids. Fire crews and civil defence were overwhelmed by the firestorm and could do nothing but try to limit the tornado of flames spreading. The devastation was unbelievable. 56% of Hamburg's dwellings had been reduced to rubble, the shipyards were decimated, all railway stations were destroyed, gas, water and electricity were cut off. And the loss of war production because of the bombing was reckoned to amount to almost 2 months' worth of output from the city. 40,000 people were killed, 125,000 wounded, and 900,000 made homeless. At the time, Albert Speer, German armaments minister, said 6 more raids like that would have ended the war, and he realised that such bombing could shatter morale and lead to the collapse of the armaments industry. Although the Allies did not have the capacity to repeat such an operation, the success of the Hamburg raids tempted Bomber Command's chief, Arthur Harris, to send his bombers to an even more lucrative target, the capital of Nazi Germany, Berlin. Bomber Command had been attacking Germany for several years since the outbreak of the war, before they set their sights on Berlin after the Hamburg raids. At first, it was the only way Britain could fight back against the Germans directly, with Hitler dominating most of continental Europe by late 1940. This soon developed into a campaign of strategic bombing. The aim was to destroy German industry by bombing factories and dehousing workers, which would also demoralise civilians. It was also launched out of a public desire to avenge the Blitz wreaked on the UK. There were heavy losses from the start, as British bombers went up against a well-prepared, well-armed German air defence system. Then, in February 1942, Harris took over as chief of Bomber Command. He brought in new tactics and new aircraft, and set the pattern of the British strategic bombing approach for the rest of the war, that of indiscriminate night area bombing. This was seen as the only option, as there was no way to see small individual targets and bomb them accurately in the dark without sustaining very high casualties. The destruction of Hamburg in July and August 1943 was one of the most effective results of this ruthless strategy, both in its ability to cripple German war production and its side effect of killing thousands. Emboldened by these raids, Harris argued that given enough time and aircraft, he could do to Berlin what he had done to Hamburg, leave it a blazing wreck and shorten the war or even end it altogether. The RAF had bombed Berlin before, but they had not been very effective, nor on the large scale Harris was suggesting. He was given the go-ahead, and the first raid was mounted on the 18th of November 1943, when 444 bombers attacked the capital. The Battle of Berlin had started. Bomber Command used a range of different planes for this campaign, although the Avro Lancaster was appearing in greater numbers by this time. Harris's bomber crews, which in each aircraft usually contained a pilot, engineer, navigator, wireless operator, bomb aimer, and two gunners, were well trained, and many had flown dozens of sorties over Germany and bombed several different places. But Berlin was different and would be more of a challenge. Firstly, it was further away from English airfields than other targets had been. To get to it, bombers had to fly deep into German territory. Not only did this mean that the flight times could be as long as 6 to 8 hours, which must have been draining to bomber crews, but this meant that Berlin was beyond the range of the RAF's radio navigation aids because it was hidden by the curvature of the earth, and the extra fuel required meant fewer bombs could be carried. The journey itself was horrible. British bombers travelled alone to a target, not in a tight formation like the Americans, but in a trail known as the Bomber Stream. The noise of the engines was biblical, the fuselage was in almost total darkness, and at that height of about 20,000 feet, it was about 20 degrees below freezing. Indeed, it was so cold that one pilot, Flight Sergeant Ronald Olsen, whilst on a mission to Berlin, suffered frostbite on his penis when it got caught on the metal funnel the crew were using as a toilet. Winter weather also hampered navigation and accuracy. Again, Olsen recalls how at times the wings froze and the windscreen frosted over, meaning he had to rely solely on instruments as he flew on blind. On one occasion, the cold weather even froze up an engine and slowed down the propellers. In this dangerous situation, Olsen had two terrible options open to him. He could either fly the plane lower to stop these freezing temperatures shutting down the aircraft, or he could try to climb above the weather, but that would use more fuel and prevent them returning to base. But, at the last moment, they flew out of the storm and got into clearer, calmer weather. Berlin itself was also formidably defended, with concentrated anti-aircraft guns and prowling night fighters bristled with radar and innovative weapons like the upward-firing Schreckmusik cannon, which allowed fighters to attack from below in relative safety. On one raid to Berlin, Olsen's Lancaster was shot at by night fighters, and they actually hit the new engine that had replaced the one that had been knocked out by the cold on the previous raid. Olsen flew back home on three engines, and had to request the fourth engine be replaced again, much to his CO's annoyance. The standard method of defence against fighters that bomber pilots could use was to corkscrew their aircraft. They would dive the bomber to port, then turn to starboard, then pull back to port, literally corkscrewing the plane in the air. Olsen recalls how sometimes he had to corkscrew his Lancaster for about an hour to get fighters off their tail. When the bomber reached the target, they had to fly in a straight line when they were about to drop the bomb load, with the pilot following directions from the bomb aimer. When over Berlin, Olsen remembers how the night then lit up from searchlights and fires down below. In such bright conditions, he could see bombers all around them, above and below. On one raid, the bomb aimer had to hold back, releasing their bombs, as another Lancaster was directly below them. During the bombing itself, German fighters would continue to attack and fly across the bomber stream like a knife, picking off a Lancaster as he went, and then turning around and repeating the manoeuvre, knowing there would be a fresh target for him. Faced with these challenges and the effective German defences, losses amongst the bomber crews soon shot up. By the time the Battle of Berlin started in November 1943, Germany's urban population had got quite used to air raid sirens going off in their towns and cities. People by then had begun to panic when they went off and rushed into public shelters in disorder, which at times caused a crush, such as in January 1944 when 30 people were trampled to death in the scramble to get into a bunker at the Hermannplatz in Berlin. Those who stayed in their own homes during the raids placed bags of sand and buckets in position to put out fires caused by the bombs, although they knew they had no protection against a direct hit. Cellar walls were also broken through to allow escape into a neighbouring house if a bomb fell on their own. One Berliner, Gerda Drews, a teenager at the time, remembers the first raid of the battle. She and her family sheltered in their own cellar that night after they heard the alarm. Whilst in there, they heard a terrible crash, and their entire house shook as a bomb fell in their neighbourhood. When they went outside afterwards, Gerda saw one of their neighbours, dead and mutilated, with his eyes hanging out of his head. This left her traumatised. From then on, Gerda and her family went to the nearest public shelter when the alarms rang out. During a raid, they could hear the whistle of bombs as they fell through the air, hear the explosions, and see the fireballs rising. Once, the bunker was almost hit, and they all felt it move. Everyone was terrified during an air attack, and mothers hugged their children, and the bunker was full of people crying and praying aloud. Throughout the battle, many familiar landmarks were destroyed in the raids, as well as most major railway stations and, ironically, the former British and French embassies. In the aftermath of a raid, dangerous ruins were sealed off, streets were cleared, and bodies collected to be buried in mass graves. Often the German authorities made prisoners from state penitentiaries defuse unexploded bombs on a usually false promise of remission of their sentence for this work. Around 50% of them were killed whilst trying to neutralise incendiaries. Messages were left for missing relatives chalked on walls of ruined houses in the hope they might still be alive. People's possessions were strewn all over the streets by the bombing, often tempting others to steal them. Yet for all this death and destruction, many of Berlin's offices and factories managed to go on functioning, and people continued to work amongst the rubble and became numbed to the raids. And the loss rates amongst bomber crews continued to go up. But Harris still pressed on with the campaign, and night after night sent out his crews to attack the big city, as they called it. Airmen like Olsen began to grow weary of constantly bombing Berlin, being such a dangerous target, to the point where some referred to Harris as Butcher Harris, out of his seeming indifference at how many air crews were being lost in his never-ending goal to smash the Nazi capital. Indeed, over the next months, Bomber Command attacked Berlin a further 18 times, a total of 9,111 sorties by March 1944. The raids ultimately killed over 9,000 and made 812,000 people homeless. Over 3,300 British pilots and crew were killed, and nearly 1,000 had to bail out into captivity. Although Harris never conceded failure in this bombing offensive, the Battle of Berlin was, in the end, a defeat for the RAF. The capital had been too well defended, and it was too difficult to target. The specific circumstances that had caused Hamburg's destruction by the British bombers could not be readily repeated and potentially contribute to shortening the war. However, Speer argued that despite the fact that strategic bombing like the Battle of Berlin didn't crush German industry, the campaign did pull thousands of troops and large amounts of military resources away from other fronts to operate the air defence system, to the point where Speer stated that the Allied bombing of Germany was almost a second front. The debate around the morality of the bombing of Germany goes on to this day. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of History Between the Lines, and if you like what you've listened to today, then please do subscribe. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.